We'll hear arguments next in 1159, Quirn against Mandley, and 1416, Califano against Mandley. Lindbergh, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I represent the Illinois state defendants in this cause, and I intend to argue for approximately 15 minutes. I will argue the position that Illinois can maintain a special assistance program for emergency needs under its regular AFDC special needs program. Mr. Keith Jones, the Deputy Solicitor General, represents the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, also a defendant in this case. He will argue the balance of the time and specifically address the subjects of the basic statutory scheme underlying the AFDC and emergency assistance programs. He'll distinguish the two programs, one from the other, and he will argue why the Social Security Act does not impose mandatory eligibility requirements on the state in that regard, and he will establish why, after the Mandley decision in this case, the first Mandley decision, the case became moot. This case arose when the plaintiffs filed a complaint alleging that the Illinois Emergency Assistance Program violated Section 606E of the Social Security Act, under which Illinois operated the program. The Illinois plan for emergency assistance covered essentially four kinds of emergency needs for AFDC-eligible individuals: homelessness due to damage of the structure, homelessness due to partial damage of the structure, and food, the court-ordered evictions, except for the nonpayment of rent. And there was a provision for ADC applicants who had not yet attained eligibility or had been established eligible that they could have food, clothing, household goods, and equipment. The plaintiff's allegations in attacking the plan alleged that the Illinois Emergency Assistance Program, as then operated, did not address the emergency needs of all destitute children. The plaintiffs in the case, the individuals, were persons who had applied for and been denied emergency assistance in that their particular need was not one of those met by the criterion that I mentioned a few moments ago. These attacks were all principally made in count one of the complaint. Count two then went on to address allegations that the Illinois plan violated the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause, because it did not provide emergency assistance to all persons facing destitution. The district court found for the state defendants and for the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. That is, he did not find a violation of the Supremacy Clause, and he did, in fact, find that the Illinois plan under created under 606E did not violate 606E of the Social Security Act. The plaintiffs appealed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which reversed the district court and found that the Illinois plan more narrowly defined eligibility than is permitted in the court's opinion under 606E of the Social Security Act. This has been referred to as the Mandley 1 decision because there is a second appeal which I will address in a moment. The case was remanded to the district court for further proceedings consistent with the court's holding. The defendants then made a motion to dismiss the case as moot for the reason that the state of Illinois had withdrawn its emergency assistance program under Section 606E and instead opted to operate an emergency needs program under the regular AFDC special needs program. The plaintiff's answer to that motion said that Illinois was continuing to operate its emergency assistance program and not under Section 606E, but under Section 402. And, of course, it is correct that they were, Illinois was operating a program of emergency assistance under its ADC provisions. The district court offered the plaintiff ample opportunity to amend its complaint and address the new program under Section 402 of the Social Security Act. The plaintiff refused to amend its complaint, and some months later, the district court granted the defendant's motion and dismissed the case as moot. The plaintiffs again appealed to the Seventh Circuit, and the Court of Appeals, again having a second opportunity at this case, concluded that the district court erred, the case was not moot, and most importantly, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals found that 606E is now the exclusive channel, statutory channel, to receive federal reimbursement for the operation of an emergency assistance program. The again, the decision was sent to the district court, and the court entered an order that was offered. The state and the secretary filed a motion, petition for a writ of certiorari, which was granted. The result of the second Seventh Circuit holding in Manley 2 is that states now can only look to Section 606E of the Social Security Act to operate an emergency assistance program for needy children. It is the position of the state of Illinois that there is no support anywhere in the Act, in the legislative history, in the administrative interpretation of the decisions of the Act, or the decisions of this Court that support the holding of the Seventh Circuit. And, in fact, what is available suggests just the opposite conclusion, that 606 is not the exclusive mechanism for the operation of emergency assistance program. The Social Security Act establishes the basic framework supporting the operation of the AFDC program by the states, and the regulations of the Secretary, perhaps as far back as 1949, recognize and authorize a special needs program under the conventional AFDC program operated by the states. Specifically, I would draw the Court's attention to Section 233.20 of the Federal Rules, the Code of Federal Regulations. If you will look in the yellow copy, which is the original brief of the state petitioners on A9, you will see the language, quoting, this is 233.20A25. If the state agency includes special need items in its standard, parenthetical A, describe that they will be recognized and the circumstances under which they will be included, and provide that they will be considered in the need determination for all applicants and recipients requiring them. Now, this is the Secretary's acknowledgement that special need items are permissible under the regular AFDC program, and it is the position of the state of Illinois that for many years, emergency needs, non-reoccurring needs of AFDC recipients have been, in fact, met under that provision, special needs, and it has been, of course, as I indicated, recognized by the Secretary.
Mr. Lindbergh, is there any further definition of special need items in the regulations or anywhere else? It's only a historic understanding upon which you're relying, as I understand it, rather than a... Special need items doesn't translate freely into...
Are you referring to the statute or the Secretary's
I'm asking,
regulations?
Is there anything anywhere defining special need items except the definition of historical experience?
I believe that what you have said is correct in your question, that it is a generally accepted, understood term of art in the field.
To cover, or at least to include, what the emergency, what's the...
Well, non-reoccurring... needs. Mr. Justice, it is most frequently referred to in connection with a state's AFDC program, where the Secretary has recognized that there are special needs from time to time. These are non-reoccurring. These are in addition to the regular established monthly grants, for example, that a family may enjoy.
Special need items doesn't freely translate into emergency assistance, does it?
Only by use and application.
And you say in your state of Illinois, the history has been that these payments do include the same payments that would have been provided under the other program.
That is correct.
And do you know about the experience or history in other states?
Yes, I understand that there are 27 states that have special need items attached to their AFDC programs, and I'm also to understand that five or slightly more of those states do meet emergency needs under their special needs item under their AFDC program. Fundamental to our...
Mr. Lindbergh, yes. Can I just be sure I'm following this? You called our attention to 233.20. That is the regulation that relates to the emergency program, isn't it?
Yes, that is correct. Special need items.
That's AFDC.
Yes.
That's the AFDC rather than the emergency.
Right.
Yeah. So that your point is that it did expressly authorize emergency assistance.
Well, my point is that there is a Secretary's regulation indicating that it is legal, regular, authorized for an AFDC program to have a special needs provision. The next step, then, I presume, from Justice Stewart's question is, does special needs include emergency assistance, too? And, of course, our position is that it does, because there was nothing in the 1968 amendment which gave rise to 606E as a new program to include a new class of people whose emergency needs could be met immediately. There was nothing in that language that rejected what the Secretary had been doing and approving all these years or what other states have been doing. Now, I cite that section only to indicate that special needs are recognized by the Secretary.
But the question, perhaps I'm repeating what Justice Stewart asked, but I want to be sure I follow up. The question that I wasn't sure of is how much of what the states had previously been doing, although it was special, could properly be classified as emergency.
Exactly.
And how do we know how much there was of that character?
I'm afraid we don't know.
The record really doesn't tell us.
No, we can indicate that there were man-made catastrophes and natural catastrophes.
I suppose the inference Mr. Justice Stewart may have been drawing is that since Congress thought that we needed another statute to deal with this problem, perhaps it's reasonable to infer that it was not adequately dealt with before.
Well, I think in part that is part of the rationale of Congress. First of all, they were concerned that there are needy children out there who have not already been pre-qualified for AFDC, but they have a need today, tonight. So they authorized this new program in 1968, saying, regardless of AFDC eligibility, for one time a year. In other words, they had some fiscal concerns. Mm-hmm. Once a year, you can meet the needs of a needy child without worrying about whether he's AFDC qualified.
For not longer than 30 days.
Not longer than 30 days in 1 year.
In any 12
months. And that was the objective of that provision. Congress obviously wanted to go beyond what was already being done, and we have no argument with that. Our position is that both programs coexist.
Well, the question to which has aroused my brother Stephen's interest as well as my own is whether or not special need items, which you tell us is nowhere defined, includes the very specific definitional emergency assistance appearing in 606E1 and reproduced on page A6 in the appendix of your brief. The term emergency assistance to needy families with children means any of the following: furnished for a period of not in excess of 30 days in any 12-month period, and so on, which is very, very specific. And the does deal with emergencies, which, as I say, doesn't translate freely into special need items.
Well, very honestly, Mr. Justice, that is a difficulty. We can search the statutes backward and forward and cannot find that type of support, nor is there any evidence to the contrary.
Mr. Jones.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The Solicitor General authorized the filing of a petition for writ of certiorari in this case on behalf of the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare because it was believed that the decisions below are counterproductive in terms of the legislative purpose of encouraging emergency assistance and also in terms of the interests of the very welfare recipients whom the Court of Appeals thought it was assisting. The legal implications of the decision below are that the federal government may no longer reimburse state payments of AFDC emergency assistance. Second, that states that wish to make federally reimbursable payments to AFDC recipients in order to alleviate the hardship that may result from emergencies must do so not under an AFDC plan, but under an EA plan. And third, that all state EA plans, whether newly created or pre-existing, must afford relief to all needy families with children. They can't just carve out certain groups who would be eligible. And they must provide need not in just certain enumerated emergencies, but in all circumstances entailing the risk of destitution. The foreseeable practical consequence, implication of this decision, we believe, would be that many states that now provide EA or AFDC emergency assistance would be required to simply abandon emergency relief altogether because they simply could not afford the extensive program devised by the Court of Appeals. In our view, this disruption of state welfare plans and policies is not required by the Social Security Act. And the burden of my argument here is that the decisions below rest upon a misreading of the scope of the AFDC and EA programs under that act. I'll begin with the AFDC program, which is by far the larger and more important of these two programs. Under AFDC, the federal government reimburses a portion of state payments of aid to families with dependent children. And Section 406 A and B of the Act define a dependent child, roughly, as a needy child who has been deprived of parental support or care as a result of the death, absence, or disability of a parent. In order to qualify for federal reimbursement for AFDC payments, a state must submit a plan to the Secretary that satisfies the requirements of Section 402A of the Act. And if the Secretary approves the plan, state payments are reimbursed according to the formula set forth in Section 403A1 of the Act, under which, as a practical matter, the federal reimbursement ranges from 50% to 65%. Alternatively, in some cases, the state may elect to have reimbursement determined under Section 1905 of the Act, and under that provision, federal reimbursement will range from 50% to a maximum of 83%. The normal mode of assistance contemplated by AFDC is regular monthly payments based upon continuing need. But the Secretary consistently and from the beginning of the, and from before the enactment of the EA program, has approved state plans that provide for supplemental payments to meet special non-recurring needs. And at least some states have included within their AFDC plans, have included within the special non-recurring items, emergency needs arising from, for example, natural or man-made disaster. Now, unfortunately, as has been pointed out, in part because of the manner in which this litigation has proceeded, the record is not satisfactory with respect to prior administrative practice. And the Secretary has never formally defined the special need items for which, since 1949, if not before, the states have been entitled to reimbursement. But in answer to your questions, Mr. Justice Stewart, it is clear that the states have included emergency items within their state AFDC plans. The booklet, which I hold here, and to which the respondents have referred in their brief.
When you say states have, you mean all states have?
Oh, not all states. Some states don't include special needs at all. Some states have no provision for special needs.
Your colleague said 27 states. Is that the figure that applies?
I think that's not accurate. I think that a total of 45 jurisdictions, and that includes not only states but certain territories, includes some kind of special need item in their AFDC plan. Unfortunately, although I would have thought at the outset of this litigation we could have identified the precise count of the number of states that provide emergency assistance under their AFDC plans, in fact, the state plans are not sufficiently specific to permit us to tell the court exactly the number of states. But just to give the court an idea, I'll read to you from this booklet a description of two state plans, which I have selected at random just here at the argument. Michigan has a special circumstance item, which is described as follows. Provisions for medical transportation, excess shelter when required to preserve equity in home, or because of family size or other unusual circumstances. That's all it says, and I cannot determine from that whether it covers the kinds of emergencies with which we are concerned here. Let me read you another one from the state of New York. It covers provisions for supplies for college or training school, attendant care, camp fees, life insurance premium, home-delivered meals, replacement of clothing lost in fire, flood, or other catastrophe, purchase of essential furniture required for establishment of a home, repair of essential heating equipment, cooking stoves and refrigerators. And I will skip some of the items. A restaurant allowance, temporary shelter and hotel, an allowance to meet increased needs of pregnant mother. There are a variety of special needs there, but it's clear that some of them include emergency needs that arise from fire or other catastrophe.
Well, I suppose the best test of the administrative interpretation of special need items is it's you're standing here on behalf of the agency telling us that they do include what Illinois is now doing.
Well, there's little more in the record. Actually, there's very little, if anything, in the record in this case which establishes prior administrative practice. Perhaps one reason why there has been little emphasis on these special items in the past is that since AFDC provides for regular monthly payments, in many cases an emergency needs can be promptly translated into a decrease in assets or an increase in expenses and therefore reflected in a changing calculus of monthly benefits. But for that or some other reason, it's true that the Secretary's construction of the Act has not been widely publicized. But there can be no doubt that the AFDC program, in fact, has been construed as permitting reimbursement of AFDC emergency benefits.
Mr. Jones, could I ask you a question that you cover as you go along? Just looking at it rather broadly, if the EA program allows 50% reimbursement, and the AFDC program allows a larger percentage reimbursement. And if the state could be covered under either program, why would it ever elect to be under the EA program?
Well,
you can give to broader categories.
That's correct, Mr. Justice Stevens.
Illinois doesn't give to broader categories.
Well, that's right, and I think, frankly, one of the mysteries in this case is why Illinois ever chose to have an EA program rather than an AFDC emergency program.
Unless it thought that was the only legitimate source of funds.
Well, there are some minor differences between the two programs that I will reach in a moment. And I have no independent knowledge of whether those differences affected the state's decision. It may be that the state was simply ill-advised. On the other hand, I should point out that the state of Illinois at the present is at the 50% level in its AFDC reimbursement. The formula under which federal reimbursement is calculated depends upon a ratio, in part at least, on a ratio of per capita income in the state to per capita income in the nation. And right now, that works out so that Illinois receives the minimum reimbursement under the statute. So for Illinois, in terms of the direct monetary reimbursement, there was probably no difference.
Was that true at the time of the program involved here, too?
I do not know, Mr. Justice Stevens. I know that since 1975, that's been the case. At any rate, our submission is that the remedial purpose of the AFDC legislation and its broad language compels the conclusion that the Secretary is authorized to reimburse the states for their emergency payments under that program. Now, whereas the AFDC program is designed to meet the needs of statutorily defined families with dependent children, that is, of one parent or of no parent families, the EA program is designed to afford short-term assistance to a much broader category of families without regard to the requirement of dependency that is the linchpin of the AFDC program. As is the case with AFDC, a state must submit to the Secretary an EA plan that satisfies the applicable requirements of Section 402A of the Act in order to qualify for federal reimbursement. Some of the requirements of Section 402A do not apply to EA plans forever, however. And in particular, the requirement in Section 402A10 that benefits be paid to all persons who satisfy the federal definition of eligibility, by its terms, applies only to AFDC plans and not to EA plans. Instead, the Secretary has indicated by regulation that the states may set their own EA eligibility conditions and may specify the particular emergency needs that their EA plans will meet. Now, a major difference between EA and AFDC, as we've already discussed, is the difference in the applicable formulas that determine federal reimbursement. EA is always at 50%, whereas depending upon the formulas that apply, AFDC reimbursement may be from 50 to 83%. And in this connection, I would like to point out a correction that we have made in our brief. In footnote 16 at page 27 of our brief, we had indicated that in some circumstances the formula for determining EA and AFDC reimbursement may be the same. That statement is incorrect. We pointed out in a letter to the clerk last August, which I understand has been distributed to the court, that different formulas always will apply to these two programs. Now, there are other significant...
Some other little typo or something in your brief, too,
That's correct. That's right, Mr. Justice Stewart. Now, there are other differences between the AFDC and the EA program, in addition to those relating to the kinds of families who are potentially eligible and the rate of federal reimbursement. One of these has already been alluded to. Whereas AFDC assistance may be continuous and emergency needs may be met whenever they arise, EA assistance is available only, as the statute says, for a period not in excess of 30 days in any 12-month period. In other words, under EA, a family is limited to one emergency per year. and there's no similar limitation under the AFDC program. And there are other differences, as we point out in our brief at pages 23 to 27, relating to work requirements, age limitations, living arrangements within the family, and family income. With this statutory background in mind, it is somewhat easier to understand the inception and to follow the progress of this lawsuit. In 1973, as has been indicated, the state of Illinois adopted an AFDC plan, and the secretary approved that plan. The state of Illinois adopted an EA plan, and the secretary approved it. The EA plan covered only AFDC beneficiaries and provided benefits in certain enumerated circumstances. As I have indicated, it's not entirely clear why the state chose to provide EA coverage, since it could have simply amended its AFDC plan to cover the same beneficiaries. Nevertheless, the state did adopt an EA program, and this litigation resulted. Respondents have challenged that EA program on two related grounds. First, they claim that the state's plan is too narrow and should be extended to all needy families with children. And second, they contend that the state should provide assistance whenever necessary to avoid destitution, and not just in certain enumerated emergencies. Our position, in essence, is that these contentions fail to make out a cause of action. The respondents have been unable to point to a source of positive law that entitles them to the extended EA coverage which they seek. Their claim is that Section 406E, which defines emergency assistance to needy families with children, constitutes a federal definition of eligibility, EA eligibility, and that Section 402A10 of the Act makes that definition mandatory upon the states. But Section 406E, the definition, does not purport to establish eligibility. It does no more than define the outer perimeter within which the Secretary may make reimbursement. Now, in doing so, Section 406E does define, in a general way, a class of potentially eligible EA recipients. But Section 402A10 does not require a participating state to make EA payments to everyone who is eligible to receive them. As the Court of Appeals recognized, and as the parties here now apparently agree, 402A10 by its terms is limited just to AFDC plans, not to EA plans. Accordingly, insofar as it rests upon the statute at all, the respondent's argument boils down to an inference from Section 402A10 that Congress intended to impose mandatory eligibility standards upon state EA programs as well as upon state AFDC programs. This argument has, we believe, three separate and independently conclusive answers. First, the logical inference to be drawn from the statutory text is just opposite to that the respondents would draw. Since Congress explicitly made 402A10 applicable only to the AFDC program, it must be inferred that Congress intended that provision would not apply to the EA program. Secondly, the respondent's argument in this case is inconsistent with this Court's reasoning in New York Department of Social Services against Dublino. In that case, the Court determined that in the absence of a clear manifestation of congressional intention, Section 402A of this Act, this very section, would not be read as restraining the considerable latitude that the states must be allowed in setting their own welfare policies. Here, there is no such clear manifestation of legislative intent, and the respondent's argument by implication does not remedy that deficiency. And third, the task of interpreting and applying this statute has been delegated in the first instance to the Secretary, and the Secretary has construed the Act as granting the states leeway to set their own EA eligibility standards. And that construction should be accorded deference in the absence of compelling legislative intent, legislative history to the contrary. And there is none here. In this regard, I would like to dispel any confusion that may have been created by the respondent's claim that the Secretary's regulations have been superseded. The respondents in their brief contend that the so-called Townsend regulations, which the Secretary adopted in the wake of this Court's decisions in King against Smith, Townsend against Swank, and Carlson against Remillard, supersede the specific EA regulations. But the Townsend regulations do no more than acknowledge the Townsend line of decisions, which were that 402A10 imposes mandatory federal eligibility requirements on AFDC programs. All the regulations do is say, in effect, that the states must abide by the requirements of the statute. The regulations do not go further and attempt to define those requirements. In particular, they do not purport to require the states to abide by a mandatory federal EA eligibility requirement. Accordingly, the Townsend regulations have not superseded the Secretary's more specific regulations relating to the EA program. For all of these reasons, we submit that the Court of Appeals erred in its first decision in this case. States participating in the EA program are not required to pay benefits to every needy family with children in every circumstance presenting the risk of destitution. Instead, they may set their own eligibility, their own reasonable eligibility standards, and limit relief to those circumstances, those emergency needs that they deem most compelling.
That was the Court of Appeals' first decision, which
that's
you say
correct.
Was
the erroneous. That's the so-called Manley 1 decision. Right. And we believe all Illinois attempted to do here was to set reasonable eligibility standards and limit relief, tailor relief, to those circumstances that met its own local needs. In any event, once the state ended the EA program that was the subject of this lawsuit, the case was moot. It makes no difference that the state then amended its AFDC plan, which it could have done from the outset, to cover special emergency needs. As I've explained at some length.
Mr. Jones, yes. is it truly moot? Because if we should buy your argument that you made thus far and let the state know that it has the option to reinstate an EA plan, is it not something that might be likely to reoccur? If the law were clarified in their favor, is it not a very realistic possibility that they would say we'll reinstate our old plan?
Well, that may very well be. One of the ironies of my situation is that if I convince you, as I think is correct, that there are substantial differences between these two programs, and you determine that once the state shifted to AFDC, the particular complaint that the respondents made was moot, then there would be no occasion for you to reach the underlying issue that the lawsuit originally involved.
That's what I was going to ask you. How many of these issues do we need to take on?
Well, I have addressed them in reverse order, Mr. Justice Stewart. I think that as a practical matter, well, let me forget about practicality. As a jurisprudential matter, I would assume that you would first determine whether, according to the allegations of the state and the secretary and the district court this time around, the lawsuit had become moot. If it had become moot, then there would be no occasion for you to address.
That's the end of it, isn't it?
That is the end of it.
And in order to.
And all of my efforts with regard to the rest of the case would have been wasted. But as I say, as a jurisprudential matter, the first issue that is before the court is that of mootness. And for that reason, Mr. Justice Stevens, although had you given an opinion with regard to the scope of the EA program, the state might have been able to take advantage of it and the litigation could have resumed.
But Mr. Jones, under the normal test, if the litigation is a real live controversy when the complaint is filed and when the district court first decides the merits, then the defendant abandons its what is held to be an illegal activity and resorts to some other program. That normally doesn't moot a case, does it, as long as the defendant can go back to what he started with under a W.T. Grant and cases like that? Isn't that exactly what we've got here?
The court would have to evaluate the likelihood that the state would recur to the behavior that caused the lawsuit to be initiated
Grant,
in the first place.
Those cases involve violators, and the idea was that after somebody has voluntarily ceased activity, the claim is made there's no point in enjoining them. But other cases held, yes, you can enjoin them because they might sometime in the future want to continue their violations. But your claim here is that there was no violation.
I think his claim is that if there was a violation, it's moot. Aren't you arguing that?
Well, there was a violation in the terms of the Court of Appeals' own order.
Right.
That is correct.
Right.
Now, the question is whether a voluntary cessation of that alleged violation is likely to be temporary or permanent.
Well, this is very voluntary if it's undertaken in the face of a court order.
Oh, no, no. The order did not require it to abandon the CA program.
I know, but it found a violation.
Because it wasn't paying to everybody.
But that would be correct in the W.T. Grant situation as well, I believe. Well, don't let me dissuade you from reaching the merits in this case.
All on your own now, what do you want us to do? On your own.
Speaking for the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, we would like this court, we would very much like the court to dispose of the merits, because that would give both the states and the federal government the guidelines.
There are at least two issues involving the merits. One is, was Manly 1 correctly decided?
And the second is whether Manly 2 was correctly decided.
And secondly, was Manly 2 correctly decided on the merits? And those are two quite different, though perhaps related issues.
Let me state my position this way. I think the court must first decide whether the AFDC plan permits the states to pay emergency benefits.
Because that's what's going on now.
That's correct. Now, if that is permissible, then, as Mr. Justice Stevens suggests, the question is whether, having shifted to a valid plan, the state has rendered moot the initial controversy. And that would depend upon an assessment of the likelihood that it might go back to its original sinful ways.
But unless this court were to consider Manly 1, the state would be forbidden by the mandate of the Court of Appeals in Manly 1 from going back to that.
Going back to EA, well, unless they paid everybody.
Not if this case were declared moot. But if the court concluded that if it held the case were moot, the state might recur to its forbidden EA program, then you'd have to conclude to the contrary that it is not moot, and therefore you would have to reach the question whether the EA program can be tailored in the way the state has done it.
Well, is W.T. Grant a mootness case?
That the discontinuance of the illegal practice is a factor the Chancellor may consider in deciding whether or not to grant an injunction, but it does not render the controversy moot. And that's exactly what we've got here.
We have proceeded under the hypothesis that the state would not revert to an EA program since it can satisfy its needs under the AFDC program. But there may be reasons why the state would actually prefer an EA program because of the differences between the two programs.
Yes, but if the state is here saying, I want it established whether I'm free to go one route or another, why is the case moot?
Well, the state has asked the case to be dismissed as moot.
Yes, but what if the state's position is that it can do either one?
That's correct.
And you do not want
You're certainly not bound by the state's view of mootness.
That is correct.
And if they are asserting that they can do either one, how is the case moot?
Let me ask you a question.
I don't understand your look.
Well, it was preparatory to a speech. We have argued that the state is so unlikely to revert to an EA program that there is no substantial probability that the W.T. Grant line of decisions will be implicated. but it may well be. I mean, that's just an evaluation of probability.
And you think the state's behavior in this case is in any way influenced by their concern about what might happen by the what the Court of Appeals in Manly 2 regarded as rather flagrant misrepresentations to the district court? And if that was all wiped clean, they might have a different attitude. I suppose there was some concern about contempt of court, wasn't there?
Well, absolutely. But if the case...
And I think in that situation, a state would have a very strong motivation for saying, this case is awfully moot, please leave us alone. But if you're talking about running a welfare program, if a lot of states, and I assume some do, want to include in their EA program certain beneficiaries who are ineligible under the AFDC program, it seems to me it's entirely reasonable to assume Illinois might want to broaden its coverage sometime in the future.
And
isn't that a likely possibility?
That is a likely possibility, or it is a possibility. And what you say also implicates the last argument we had made in our brief with regard to the propriety of the scope of relief ordered by the Court of Appeals. The case was certainly, well, in our evaluation, the case was moved in the district court. Once the Court of Appeals broadened the relief of Manly 1 in its Manly 2 judgment, then the implications of that decision certainly extended beyond the state of Illinois. And although the case might be moot as to Illinois, arguably it might not be moot as to many other states which would be concerned about the validity of their current programs. Now my time has expired.
So that's how you...
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I believe that the arguments that you have heard from the petitioners point out the difficulties that they bring to a court when they don't follow orderly appellate procedures. And I would like to briefly state what the procedures have been so far in my opening statement. More than 2 years ago, the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Manly 1 held that Illinois could not grant federally funded emergency assistance to some needy families eligible under 406E of the Social Security Act while denying it to equally eligible families under the Act. This decision came approximately 2 years after the complaint was filed in the Northern District of Illinois. In so holding that Illinois' definition of emergency need conflicted with the federal definition of emergency assistance to needy families with children contained in Title 4A of the Social Security Act, the Court of Appeals followed a line of unanimous decisions of this Court, starting with King v. Smith, Townsend v. Swank, Remillard v. Carlson. Now, rather than comply with the Court of Appeals ruling or abandon federal funds or petition this Court for certiorari, the Illinois welfare officials, with the cooperation and approval of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, implemented a fictitious abandonment of federal funds for emergency assistance, which has enabled it to maintain its illegal program for more than 2 years after the judgment in Manly 1.
Is it your position that Manly 2 is an entirely separate litigation from Manly 1?
We believe it's a sequel, Your Honor, but it's different. In that,
is it a different case in the district court?
No, both decisions arose from the same complaint, Your Honor.
So then, this court is not bound, of course, by any court of appeals decision, and I presume the parties to Manly 1 are not bound under any doctrine of res judicata by Manly 1.
I believe they are bound under Manly 1, of course. The petitioners did not...
You believe they are bound? In what sense?
Law of the case.
It's the law of the case, Your Honor.
Well, but it's not law of the case in this court. No. It's law of the case in the Seventh Circuit. Nope.
I understand that, Your Honor. We do say that the petitioners did not follow the orderly procedures to present this case for review on certiorari, should this court deem it worthy of certiorari, after the judgment in Manly 1. That has resulted in the Court of Appeals having to make a second decision to enforce its first decision, and further resulted in many needy families in the state of Illinois being denied emergency assistance. This is a case where the state has taken tactics to delay. What they did is they merely relabeled their emergency assistance plan as special assistance, submitted it to HEW without giving any notice to the court or to the respondents that they had done this. HEW approved that plan for federal funding, placed a stamp of approval on it.
Why should they have given notice to the court?
They should have given notice to the court because it's a court of equity that was considering an emergency assistance program. This program was identical. There was not one change from it. It was in violation of the mandate in Manly 1. It was within the parameters of our complaint because we alleged that their program violated federal and state law.
There were parties to litigation.
There were parties to litigation? Thank you, Your Honor.
Will you say that as soon as you're a party to a litigation, then whatever you do thereafter, you have to give notice to the court in which the litigation was commenced?
If it affects the litigation.
Well, Your Honor, I think it is clear that it did affect, in our opinion, the litigation. It was clear in the Court of Appeals' opinion that it affected the litigation. The Court of Appeals found that the petitioners had engaged in circumvention of the mandate of Manly 1, and we believe the Court of Appeals is clearly correct in that for all the reasons that they lay out in their opinion. HEW, as I said, also approved this plan without giving any notice to the court or to the respondents.
Was HEW a party to the first litigation?
They were, Your Honor. They were joined on the motion of the state of Illinois. HEW, the petitioners then advised the district court that Illinois no longer had an emergency assistance plan. Contrary to the representations made here today, they did not tell the court that they were going to fund the program as a regular AFDC. They had asked the court for more time to consider what to do after the mandate in Manly 1 came down because they wanted to consult certain legislative committee, at which time they proposed the plan to avoid the mandate. That was on November 17th. This is noted in the opinion. I happened to have been at the committee meeting that day, and the next day they came into court and told the court that they were going to fund this program solely with state funds. The Court of Appeals noted that also. By doing so, they obtained a dismissal eventually that the case was moot. On appeal, again, the Court of Appeals in Manly 2 promptly reversed and remanded with a direction to the district court to enter the proposed final judgment and decree with certain modifications. This was 1 year ago, despite this court's denial of a stay of mandate to HEW and to the state. The district court has declined to enforce the judgment pending this court's review. Now, the petitioners say that the judgment in Manly 2 was wrong and unnecessary, and moreover now claim that the Court of Appeals erred in Manly 1 as well. We think that Manly 2 was right and needed, although we hold the same opinion, obviously, as to Manly 1, although we don't think the petitioners have properly sought review of that decision in this court. The respondents conceive that a federal judicial power has substance in our national life and in our constitutional governments. If it's a power not subject to defeat at the hands of resistant litigants, then the Court of Appeals' judgment must be upheld. The Court of Appeals in Manly 1 considered, for the first time by a Court of Appeals, the 1968 congressional enactment of an emergency assistance program. This program had a number of purposes. It provided that both people eligible for AFDC and people eligible, not eligible for AFDC, would be eligible for emergency assistance. It did provide short-term help to help get a family over a crisis, so that they might not have to be dependent upon the regular aid program. In addition, they provided emergency help for families already receiving regular AFDC or families eligible to receive it. In fact, the Senate report noted that this type of family would be the typical type of family that would be eligible for emergency assistance, the family who is or eligible to receiving AFDC. The legislation authorized emergency needs to be met immediately by giving flexibility as to the form of payment. A state could provide the payment in a hurry by cash, by in-kind, by vendor payments, or such other method as the state might specify. The program was optional with the states, and it was limited to a 30-day period and a 12-month period. And to encourage the states to participate, Congress offered the state's 50% matching funds for payments made as emergency assistance. Now, under this legislation, there are 5 points of eligibility. There must be a needy child under the age of 21 living now or recently with a relative. The child must be without available resources, and the payment must be necessary to avoid the destitution of a child or to provide the living arrangements in a home for a child. And neither the child nor the relative can have refused without good cause to accept employment or training for employment. In 1971, Illinois adopted its first emergency assistance program under Section 406C. It provided nearly complete eligibility in terms of the federal statute. It provided that the aid would be given from the local district, local offices throughout the state by a dispersing order. That's a form given to a merchant for, say, $10 for food or $15 for clothing or whatever. In 1973, the state administratively constricted eligibility in the face of contrary state legislation, which requires them to have a full program, and limited emergency assistance to new applicants for AFDC, to recipients who are homeless from a result of fire, and recipients who are evicted for reasons other than nonpayment of rent. And I've noticed in their regulations just this summer that they have eliminated even those evictions. So now any family evicted in Illinois who is without available resources cannot receive any emergency assistance from the public aid department. In addition, they excluded all non-AFDC eligible families. As a result of this, no relief from destitution was available to many families lacking food and clothing. All evictions now, crimes against persons or property, utility failures or turnoffs, as a result of agency error or delay, or if a child was abandoned by a parent. The state also centralized the distribution of emergency assistance in the state capital. If an applicant's request was approved, the caseworker mailed the form to Springfield for final approval, and then if that was approved there, a check was mailed back to the recipient somewhere in the state. As a result of these procedures, Illinois cut its expenditures for emergency assistance from $2.5 million a year to $500,000 a year. In doing so, they referred many of the people they used to aid to private charities, some of whom have joined this suit as amicus curiae. For instance, the United Way of Metropolitan Chicago, one of its components, the Council for Community Services, which is an umbrella group of about 280 private charities or social service agencies, is an amicus curiae in this suit. These charities, lacking a regular budget to provide the need that the state has traditionally provided and ought to provide, have been unable to help many of these poor people, and these people then are now just suffering, bearing their own suffering, as this court said, I think, in the Maricopa County case. Illinois testified at the trial the reasons they constricted the program were for administrative ease and to prevent abuses and fraudulent applications. The district court ruled that the department was processing applications much too slow, that delays of 7 to 10 days in assistance were not uncommon. They held for the state and federal defendants on the eligibility provision. On appeal, the Court of Appeals in Manly 1 reversed, holding the states could Illinois could not constrict eligibility among needy families, following the line of decisions that this court has made. And it's an important principle that they follow, because by doing so, they ensure that the people get the aid that Congress meant to have the aid. Further, the court in Manly 1 followed what I think is a traditional pattern in practice in litigation, at least in my knowledge of it. When they invalidate a regulation of an agency, be it federal or state, they did not order HEW to file draft regulations with the court that conformed to Manly 1. They suggested that it would be helpful to the states and to the courts if HEW would exercise its rulemaking power to give a new regulation to replace the one that the court invalidated. In following the principle this court has set, which I believe is stated succinctly in Townsend versus Swank, that states may not vary eligibility requirements from federal standards in the absence, at least, of an authorization clearly evidenced upon the Act or its legislative history, Court of Appeals applied that test to the Illinois situation, and it found in Section 406E1 two areas of state discretion and no more. It found found an area of discretion for the form of payment. The state could, as I said, make cash or vendor payments. And it found that the states could, in 406E2, include migrant workers if they wished. But there was no, evidence on the act, in the act, to allow it to exclude the families that Illinois had excluded. This pointing out of areas of state discretion is, as this court noted in Townsend, cogent evidence that Congress intended no further discretion to be given to the states to narrow eligibility. And indeed, the petitioners point to no evidence on the basis of
Mr.
statute.
Mr. Lefkoe, don't you leap one point? At least they say you don't. I'll be sure I have your answer to it. They say that the mandatory language in 402A10 is it that was controlling in Townsend doesn't apply to the EA program. And therefore, you don't have the same argument that you had in Townsend. Now, what's your answer to that?
My answer is that there's an error in their understanding, I believe, of the case. The cases. First, we would say that the result is the same whether 402A10 applies or not, because the principle of this court's decisions is the conflict of the state regulation with the federal statute and not 402A10. In 402A10, the court focused on making sure that all eligible individuals received assistance. For instance, in Townsend, the court italicized the term all eligible twice in the opinion. Moreover, 402A10 would not normally have emergency assistance because it's an optional program with the state. Once, this is our argument that it applies, once a state opts to provide emergency assistance, then 402A10 would become operative. In other words, the term aid to families with dependent children includes whatever aid is provided under Title 4A.
And further, for a minute, yes. You are for affirming completely. Do you have any quarrel with the second opinion?
We have no quarrel, Your Honor.
Now that you've been interrupted, Mr. Lefkoe, I'm not sure I understand what you say is now before the court. As I understand, a petition for certiorari was granted to review Manley 2.
Yes.
Is that correct? And Manley 2 really presents only the issue of whether the program that Illinois is now carrying on under the AFDC is permissible under AFDC. Is that correct?
Yes, that's essentially correct.
That's really what it comes down to. And if we hold that it is, you lose, and that's the end of the case. And if we hold that it isn't, you win, and that's the end of the case that way, without considering Manley 1 at all or without considering mootness at all. Isn't that correct?
Well, I think it would be very difficult, Your Honor, to reverse Manley 2 without considering Manley 1.
Well, if this is a permissible course of action, which Illinois has now taken under its understanding of the authorization given to it by the AFDC provisions, then that's the end of it, isn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
No, why not? I thought you said you agreed with me at first.
Well, if I did, let me
all right,
make
you,
a small
do,
distinction.
It's not clear to me just what we have here before.
It seems to me that they've accepted Manley 1, and that is that emergency assistance is provided pursuant to Section 406E1 of the Act if they accept federal funds. Does that clarify it for
I'm
you?
I'm not sure it does, and maybe it's because of my lack of
I don't see how Manley 1 is here at all. Assume that nothing was done. You couldn't bring Manley up now, could you? It's dead.
We would be in agreement.
What makes Manley alive now?
Manley 1.
Manley 1.
Your Honor, the reason it's to any extent alive is we oppose the petition for petitions for certiorari, and the court did not expressly limit the grant of jurisdiction to Manly 2, so we felt compelled, of course, to brief the merits in Manly 1 and to present an argument upon it. Well, I'll make no further argument.
You can see.
I'm asking you, how do we get it? Can you give me any time where we've had a case like this?
Where the federal defendant has waited 548 days to petition for certiorari? I don't know of any cases.
No, of where you have two cases and one is past the time for certiorari. And once the period of time to apply for certiorari is over, that's a judgment, isn't it?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
Is it final?
The Manly 2 Court...
Is it final?
In my opinion, it is, Your Honor. And Manly,
well, was it appealed in this case?
No, there's no. No, it was not.
Well,
although the HEW did receive from this court an extension of time within which to petition for certiorari.
To review the Manly 2 decision?
No, to review Manly 1.
Oh, but then did not petition.
Did not petition. Uh-huh. And the Court of Appeals in Manly 2 noted that they considered Manly 1 final. And I think, of course, from the Court of Appeals' position, they had to consider Manly 1
final.
Well,
are any of the issues raised in the petition for certiorari in this case that's now before us dependent in any way on or question any way Manly 1?
Yes, they do.
Well, then I don't see how you can say that Manly 1 is not before us in the sense that petitioners are entitled to argue, perhaps unsuccessfully, whatever issues they raised in their petition for certiorari. You say it's the same complaint, simply went back to the district court on remand after Manly 1. And certainly we are not bound by the law laid down by the Seventh Circuit in the first Manly 1 case.
Your Honor, I wouldn't suggest that this court could not review Manly 1. What I've tried to suggest is that the petitioners have not followed orderly appellate procedures.
Would you say that if the Illinois welfare people had never tried what they tried in Manly 1, under AFDC, and simply started the program challenged in Manly 2, that the case would before us would be any different than the one that now is?
That's it, isn't it? Whether Illinois can permissibly do what it's now doing under AFDC.
The answer to that is, I think, Your Honor, if they believe they can do it, they should have told the district court the first time. They should have put it in the
answer to their complaint. Was that a federal question?
It is a federal.
I mean, that's maybe a failure of protocol or courtesy, but I'm asking what issues are before us? Isn't it just the permissibility under AFDC of what Illinois is now doing? You concede, don't you, that any state can abandon an EA program? It's a voluntary program. It can go into it and it can go out of it, can't it?
Well, it would depend on the state's own law. For instance, in Illinois has a statute that requires the state to cooperate with the federal government and to fully participate in all available federal programs. So we don't think that the state of Illinois is
a
matter of
state law. State law.
Right, but we allege that in our complaint, Your Honor.
As a matter of state
law. State
law,
they cannot refuse to provide
emergency
assistance.
No concern of ours, the law of Illinois.
Mr. Lefkoe, can I approach this from just a slightly different angle? Assume, contrary to the suggestions that have been made so far, that the court should address Manly 1 as the first issue. And assume further, and I'm not suggesting this would be the conclusion, that the court should disagree with you and reverse Manly 1. Would it not be true that in that set of circumstances, you would have no interest in the outcome in Manly 2? There'd be no reason to reach Manly 2 if we did it that way. As if we held that the state could grant less than the federal government authorized, which it tried to do in the first instance, and we rejected your argument there, wouldn't that end the litigation?
No, it would not, Your Honor, because as we mentioned, the state has a statute which requires them to fully participate. And number two, we have alleged an equal protection violation.
But say we disagreed with you entirely on the merits of your claim that they must provide more than they originally provided
under EA.
Then you really don't have any reason to object to the program now in effect, because all you'd be saying now is that you can't even it's wrong to do as much as you're doing.
Well, Your Honor, my clients would have a reason to object to it, but whether it be a legally cognizable reason would be another question.
I think it's critical to your case that you win on Manly 1, or we assume Manly 1 was correctly decided, one of the two.
Well, we certainly believe that it was.
However, we
decided.
Do it, law of the case or merits or anything. There's no reason to get to Manly 2 if we don't make the assumption that you correctly prevailed in Manly 1. It seems to me otherwise you have no interest in Manly 2.
Well, there is a question whether, quite apart from previous history, whether a state right now can, under AFDC authority, do what Illinois is doing, or must it do more.
But this litigant has no interest in that question unless it was right in Manly 1.
Well, Your Honor, there is no express authority in the Social Security Act for providing emergency assistance as a special need. And you heard the...
Well, that's the question.
You heard the petitioners have, I believe, conceded that point right here in this court. And if the legislative language of the statute, the language of the statute is not clear enough, the legislative history clearly confirms that this was a new program and that if any authority, which we don't believe existed, had lied with HEW to provide special needs, provide emergency assistance as a special need, it was clearly superseded by the clear congressional direction in 406E in 1968. And that, you raised this question right at the start, I believe, with the petitioners, and it struck me. They cited this Handbook of Public Assistance Administration regulation, which was the book of regulations HEW had before they began promulgating them in the Federal Register and Code of Federal Regulations. And they read that special need regulation to the court. There's no mention in it of emergency assistance. What they did not mention in their briefs or in their argument here is that prior to 1968, HEW had some regulatory material on emergency situations that we cited in our brief as Section 3434.2 of the Handbook of Public Assistance Administration. They had one on emergency payees. They had a section on emergency situations prior to complete determinations of eligibility. If HEW had any authority at all to provide emergency assistance, it would have been under these provisions. But I think it's clear from the testimony of the administration's only witness at the Senate hearings, who was Undersecretary Wilbur Cohn, that HEW had viewed that they had no authority. Undersecretary Cohn testified there is no mechanism in existing law to meet the emergency needs of children in a crisis situation. And the remarks on the floor of both the Senate and the House reflect that it was a new law. It was a change in the existing law. For the first time, the federal government will match payments for emergency assistance. So I think it's pretty clear, whatever may have been before, the congressional direction in 1968 clearly pointed the way for states to provide emergency assistance if they provided it at all. And under the cooperative federalism, which pervades the Social Security Act, the states don't have the ability to tailor eligibility. They have been given the right to set the standard of needs. Now, Illinois, for instance, in, say, providing shelter for somebody who is destitute, they don't have to buy them a house. They don't have to pay them 2 months back rent. If they could find a barracks that was, in Chicago, it's pretty cold right now, but it was heated and it was adequate. This is a minimal program. This is not a support program in the sense that the AFDC program is a support program. The standards of the Act itself say that the payments have to be necessary to avoid destitution, so that there's not going to be probably any fat in the payments that the state makes.
It's sort of an emergency disaster program, and that's what it is.
Well, it's not a disaster.
It's limited to 30 days in any 12-month period, and the state can set the need, the amount, can it?
Yes, Your Honor, subject to providing aid to really relieve destitution. For instance, they, at a minimum, the federal...
For evictions or casualty losses and so on.
Well, or food or clothing or shelter.
But resulting from emergency catastrophes, isn't it?
Well, it doesn't have to result
from... Or individual catastrophes. It doesn't have to...
Well, the language of the reports and the remarks on the floor is that when a family suffers an emergency without limitation as to the cause or the type, for instance, the legislation itself expresses that there's only one case of fault where a person will be denied assistance, and that's when they refuse to accept employment or training for it. So I think Congress has clearly expressed, we want to protect children. We don't want any children to be without the very essentials of life. Because really, this is what this country is about, is trying to make a better life for everyone, I think.
And I think Congress...
what this legislation's about.
Certainly is. And it's a sound social policy that Congress has adopted in this legislation. We would say, one further point on Manly 2 is that there's no evidence in the statutes of the dual authority to provide emergency assistance that the petitioners claim. There is simply one way, and that is it has to meet the eligibility requirements of Section 406E. Now, I do want to make a reference to this idea that 45 states provide special needs, and I believe that there's an inference that many states provide emergency assistance. Well, I think one of them did say that only 5 states provided assistance. And from what we have gleaned from this document of HEW, which is not really very clear, only 5 states provide some very limited items of assistance. But in their brief, HEW concedes 27 states participate in the emergency assistance program. 15 of them, and I'm not sure if this is in the brief, but 15 of them have full eligibility as required by Section 406E, and the other 12 have differing degrees of eligibility.
But differing, but all less than the full.
Right.
So all of those 12 would be in violation under Manly 1, correct?
That would be correct, Your Honor. We believe that Manly 2 was clearly correct on the law. Its analysis of the legislation and the history of the legislation, I think, prohibits their conduct and prohibits their claiming funds in this manner. If they had had a reasonable basis for believing it, I think that they would have advanced it long before presenting it for the first time to the Court of Appeals in Manly 2. They never told the district court on remand that we can do it this way. They wanted to keep it a secret, an administrative secret perhaps. It was, and they kept it a judicial secret. I don't see how a court can function unless it gets full advocacy of the truth. I'd like to turn, if I may, to the relief question. The facts show that this is a most unusual case. I think it's a unique case. HEW had issued a regulation. It was invalidated. A regulation on emergency assistance, Your Honor. It was invalidated. The court in Manly 1 invited HEW to issue a new one. HEW did not issue a regulation. It did not petition for certiorari. What it approved Illinois' plan without any regulation at all. This is a message to the states that you can ignore Manly 1. You can ignore judicial decisions because we're going to put the stamp on your plan and you can carry that over to the Secretary of the Treasury and collect your 50% reimbursement. Now, they also did not redefine their special need regulation. They could have put in eligibility standards in that if they really believed that they could do it under AFDC. They could have put in a timeliness requirement. Because there's no, under AFDC, there is no forthwith requirement as there is in emergency assistance. The only requirement now is that a person receive assistance within 45 days. And emergency assistance delayed is emergency assistance denied. They didn't make any recommendations to Congress that they needed new legislation or hold any hearings in the states to see if there were any problems in administering an emergency assistance program as the Court of Appeals in Manly 1 defined it. They engaged in a circumvention of the mandate, and the Court of Appeals in Manly 2 found that they had indeed circumvented the mandate. Under those circumstances, it would have been 3 years since the complaint was filed in a case involving the needs of people in most dire straits, and 1 year since the mandate had been returned with no action by HEW. Well, I won't say no action. They had approved the plan illegally. The court, considering Manly 1 was a final judgment, granted what we believe is equitable relief. It ordered HEW not to approve plans inconsistent with 406C, and it directed them to issue a new regulation to replace the old one. And I think that this is important. They modified the judgment that was proposed by the plaintiffs, and they removed from it the requirement on HEW to define certain terms of the 406C definition. HEW was not, I think perhaps it's best, easiest to just cite what the Court of Appeals said. It didn't require us to HEW to define necessary to avoid destitution or lack of available resources. Those terms were not really at issue in this litigation. What the court said is this: while it would be salutary to include such definitions in the new regulation, and while the secretary might find it necessary as administrative find it necessary as a matter of administrative practicality to include any items in its new to include them, we will not order HEW specifically to include any items in its new regulation. Of course, whatever regulations the Secretary issues must be consistent with today's opinion and Manley 1.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, you may continue.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I would like to clarify our position in regard to emergency assistance and special needs, or emergency assistance as a special need. Our position is this. If a state should be allowed by this court to grant emergency assistance as a special need, a state must still do so in accord with the eligibility requirements of Section 406E. Congress in Section 403A5 of the Act, which is the funding provision, provides that for federal reimbursement, if a state makes payments as emergency assistance to needy families with children, it must, and that is contained, that statute is contained in the yellow brief at page A4.
Page what?
A4. It's a, on A4 is a continuation of the full statute set out. It begins at A2.
Right.
And at A4, subparagraph in parentheses 5, and the previous parts would read with it, the Secretary of the Treasury shall pay to each state which has an approved plan for aid and services to needy families with children, in the case of any state, an amount equal to 50% of the total amount expended under the state plan during such quarter as emergency assistance to needy families with children. This language reflects that Congress contemplated the function of emergency assistance. If it had just meant emergency assistance in 406E, it might have said of emergency assistance to needy families with children, but it said as. And I can think of no better words to sum it all up than to repeat what Judge Cummings said, writing for the court in Manley 2, a rose is a rose is a rose. Emergency assistance is emergency assistance, no matter what the state may call it. And the Solicitor General here today acknowledges that he doesn't know why the state participated in 406E if they can do the same thing as a special need. And I suppose that we could all say that if that view should prevail here, that we don't know why Congress enacted 406E. But we think Congress had a very special reason to enact it, and that was to make sure that all needy families with children who faced these dire circumstances and had no available resources to meet an emergency needs received some aid. And a contrary result would mean that the statute, Congress's statutes, would be, as the Court of Appeals said in Manley, too, totally eviscerated. On the other points that are raised concerning relief, both as to the federal and the state defendants, we believe that they are fully covered in our briefs. There hasn't been any contest on their part about them. We believe that the Court of Appeals was clearly correct in ordering the relief that it did and that it should be sustained. The result reached in Manley 1 and Manley 2 is a just result. Our elected representatives have adopted a sound social policy in the emergency assistance provisions of the Social Security Act. The federal and state welfare agencies charged with the duty to administer that policy have, the Court of Appeals has ruled, illegally refused to discharge their obligations to the great injury of people in most dire straits and to the public good as well. The beneficiaries of Congress's providential policy, whom we represent, appeal to this court to confirm the protections afforded them below by the Court of Appeals by affirming the judgment of the court.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.